soon as the blue light comes on, we're good to go. The Senate Interim Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness will come together. Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Olson. I'm happy to be back here again. Hopefully everyone had a good summer. I just wanted to make one comment. There's been a surge in Oregon military suicides, and I was sent a, you have one from the Oregonian, and mine's from the Oregonian, too. All right. But Oregon, four so far in 2013, that was as of September 10th, and I'm hoping that during the next legislative session, maybe not 2014, but at least 2015, we spend a little bit more time on what is our department doing with suicides in the military. And everyone says yes, and we've talked about this before, and yes, we have a suicide hotline, but I think there needs to be a whole lot more than just that. And I think it's extremely important, very important, especially for males who never like to say anything's wrong with them. And so when it comes to mental illness. So that's my comments for the day. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair. And next interim meeting, which is in November, it's the military department's turn, so you'll be able to ask all those questions.
Thank you.
And I'm hoping to meet, the Adjutant General and I were going to meet, I think, yet tomorrow, but he's had other engagements, so that's been put off for a little bit of time. And I know the presiding officer is supposed to meet with the Adjutant General next week. So I think those will be topics of discussion with the Adjutant General when we come forward. Very good. Madam Counsel, I think this is the organizational meeting, which means we're supposed to adopt rules that senators never follow anyway. So why don't you review the rules for us, and then we'll go from there.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the interim rules are modeled on the chamber rules for the interim, and they are substantially identical to the previous interim's rules, and they are identical from committee to committee, so far as I'm aware. You are, of course, permitted to amend them with proper notice, but committees typically don't. So right now they're all identical.
Substantially identical or identical?
Substantially identical. There's a little piece in the last proposed rule that makes it explicit that when committees go on a tour, we write a little summary of the tour. Okay. And that wasn't in the previous interim rules, but it's common. It's what we practice anyway.
Well, the state's got to change. So. Madam Vice Chair.
Chair Bocas, I move to adopt the proposed interim committee rules dated today, September 16, 2013.
Madam Vice Chair Mona Sanderson moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated today. Is there any discussion? Senator Olson.
No.
Senator Mona Sanderson. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Rules are adopted. With that, colleagues, we're going to go right down the schedule. I think several of us have other engagements this morning. Today is primarily Veterans Department Day. Military Department Day is next month. I would, before we go down the schedule farther, is remind the Department of Veterans that if there is a bill or something that needs to be, or tweaking that needs to be done that takes legislative action in the February session, we have to take action of that on the committee to put a bill in place at the November legislative day. So the clock is ticking if there is something the department would like us to take up. With that, we're going to go right down the calendar on Senate Bill 762 update, and then we're going to move on to the Veterans Affairs Advisory update. And for efficiency, we're going to let the director stay up here the entire time. Mr. Director.
Good morning, Chair Boquist, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cameron Smith, and I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. And with the chair's blessing, I'd like to flip-flop from the more general overview of our advisory committee report and then dig in more tactically.
Mr.
on
Director,
the suicide issue.
You may flip if you would like.
I will not admit to flip-flopping, but in this one case.
I'm wearing boots, not flip-flops, for the record.
Good morning again. It's a privilege to be back in front of you. We have had a busy summer working to both implement legislation and both turning with our team to our core work. And I keep going back and forth in my mind. Every generation thinks their time is unique. But I truly think this time right now is a turning point for Oregon and the nation in our service of veterans. We're serving four generations of veterans across five major wars, so World War II, Korea, Vietnam, the Gulf War, and Iraq and Afghanistan. And right now, just walking from ODVA to the Capitol on this gorgeous September day, it does not feel like we're a nation at war. But we obviously still have thousands deployed to Afghanistan. And just last month, we had our most recent casualty, an Oregonian Army Specialist, Nick Welch, of Mill City, and his family is now in Salem, died of an IED blast. Three of his fellow soldiers died right away in Afghanistan. He held on, was transported back to Germany, and made it all the way back to D.C. Before finally succumbing to his injuries. So this is very real, both for our older and aging veterans and our most recent veterans, and I just feel privileged to work with our team at ODVA and with our cross partners trying to bring better services and benefits to our veterans. And I will try to move quickly. We did... knowing that this is the first day of legislative days and you all have much work to do, feel free to interrupt with any questions, but we'll move quickly through the annual report and then dig in on the suicide issue. So this is the advisory committee report. We have a 9-member advisory committee body from veterans from every era. We don't have World War II serving on our committee, but across the state, from rural Oregon to urban, to the coast. And it is a group that we are trying to have more engaged, more active, truly giving us their best advice and counsel and linking us to the community. And all of you received an electronic copy of this report, but it details kind of the where we are at this turning point. We're calling this a new cadence, knowing that we have to, that it's beyond just ODVA's work. It's with our partners in the Guard and our broader partners that we need to align veterans care and benefits across Oregon. And this is for our 320,000-plus veterans that are Oregonians. About 1 in 10 of our citizens are veterans. And as we've discussed before, this is a diverse population across eras, so every age, gender. Women are an increasing demographic for veterans. We have the urban, we have the rural. A diverse population in and of itself that then has diverse needs across healthcare, education, employment, housing. It can begin to boggle your mind how one agency can structure itself budget-wise, staffing-wise, resource-wise to truly meet those needs. And that's where we come up with that new cadence. It's only going to be when we're aligning the diverse partners to serve our diverse veterans with all of those different needs. We are very proud of the work that ODVA does as a center of gravity and as the main lead agency for our veterans. We've got great core programs in terms of our claims and counseling and our partnership with the counties on that front. Our veterans home loan program, distinct from the federal VA loan, and then our veterans homes, the one in the Dalles that was built out in the late 90s, and then the one that's being built currently down in Lebanon. What it really comes down to on those core programs truly is the great people that we have on our team. We had about 20% of our team retire this summer. Both, I'm saying it's not because of the new director, but some of the PERS conversations, and we've just been a long-tenured agency. When I walked around on my first day back in March, there have been folks who've been working at ODVA for longer than I've been alive. About 20%, both key administrators like Tom Mann and our Veteran Services and employees throughout the organization. It's great to be bringing on new and fresh eyes and new folks to look at our work, but also a challenge losing that expertise. But also want to reintroduce Eric Belt, who's going to be taking over for Tom Mann. He comes from Washington County. He was leading their Veteran Service Officer and their team of five Veteran Service Officers in Washington County, and was also the president of the county's association of their VSOs. And then we're bringing on Lori Skillman, who is coming to us from the real estate agency board, or real estate agency, and is going to be our senior policy advisor in that sweet spot for state government across legislation, rules, and policy, and really looking both strategic and tactically across our agency. So some great new team members that we're bringing on, and a lot of excitement on that front. we know that it's also going to be the resources that we bring to bear with those people in terms of our budget and training. But we're also looking at how do we hold ourselves accountable, not just to good intentions and the political goodwill that exists around veterans, but really looking at a performance management system where we're truly digging in, not just on our key performance measures, but core processes to achieve our programs across claims, home loan, and the veterans home, to know what do we really want to measure, who's the process owner on that, and how are we going to hold ourselves accountable to meet that. And I just came back from Nashville over Labor Day weekend from the State Association of the NASDVA, the National Association of State VA Directors, and I am confident that we have one of the top 10 programs in the nation after talking to my fellow directors. Oregon brings down $1.9 billion in federal resources in health care, disability, and pension payments, education benefits, employment resources, and burial benefits, to just name a few. That said, we were seventh in the nation in disability and claims and compensation. And that speaks, I think, to the strong people that we have in place and those partnerships with the counties. But there is significant room for improvement just in our core program. So we've been digging in hard on the Veterans Home Loans program. A lot of different changes, kind of small technical fixes, came out of the last legislative cycle that now allow us to feed that into our strategic plan going forward on the home loan program, what has been a heavy funder of our other operations. Yes, sir.
Go ahead. Finish your statement.
So our home loan program was the original reason that the agency stood up back in 1945 after World War II, has gone from hundreds of thousands of loans on the books down to 2,000 loans on the books. We believe with the flexibility we now have and with some new folks coming on, breathe new life into that program. Whether it will begin to continue to fund our other operations or not, it remains to be seen. But knowing that that is a core benefit of and to itself for our veterans.
There we go. Mr. Chair.
Mr. Olson.
I try to avail myself of the Veterans Home Loan and was eligible to receive it. The process is extremely burdensome and difficult. I received the letter saying that I was eligible with no further documentation, no further course of action other than to say, find a lender who will do this. And I couldn't. And I thought that was a little bit arbitrary to say that an ODVA loan is out there available to a veteran, but it was nigh unto impossible to get. Every lending institution I talked to said, we don't do that. We'll do the federal VA, but we won't do the state VA. I think you really need to focus on that to make that available. It was a great program. Fortunately, I was able to get a different loan to modify my current mortgage because of the interest rates. That's what I was after. But to have to go through the onerous process that was available from the ODVA was ridiculous, and there really wasn't any assistance available to say, this is where you need to go, this is how you need to proceed, and this is how you need to get it done. And I thought, to get the letter saying I was qualified was exceptional, but after that, it just fell off the cliff. So I would maybe take a look at that and see what you could do to improve that situation.
So Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, not every government program needs to be run like a business, and there are unique factors on the public side, but this very much is a home loan business being run within the Department of Veterans Affairs, and there is significant room to grow on that front in terms of how we, our core processes right now, what you mentioned in terms of referring that business back out to our partners to originate those loans. The incentives aren't always aligned. The communication and relationships haven't always been built. We have to be able to own that product from the get-go, not just simply refer it out like you experienced.
Well, I remember in our last session we talked, and I was actually in a meeting that we talked about how to make this process work, how to grow that business, because you said, as you said, they're down to 2,000, and how to grow that business. And the business model that you have absolutely positively will not grow that business.
Correct.
Because it's so confusing. It's impossible for a veteran to
find out exactly how to make that loan work and where to do it. If you were to simply put down, we have these partners on the outside that will do these loans, and make a list of those so that it's convenient for everybody in the state to, you know, like over in Baker or wherever, then that would really, really expedite the system and make it easy to make it work. But there was no follow-up with who do you go to, who do you talk to, what lending institution actually does this. And it just the simplicity of a list saying these lending institutions will be available for you to do this would make the process so much easier, because I had no idea who to contact. It would just say contact your mortgage broker or a lending institution. Well, when you go through about five or six and everybody says, no, we don't even have a clue on how to do an ODVA loan, they're where you need to clean that and help it, because I think your business could expand. Now, the problem is that the interest rates are now going up. So if you're going to remain viable, you know, and you're going to be lower than everybody else, this is when you really need to get that program up and running for the veterans.
Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, I couldn't agree more. A rising interest rate will help our program, oddly enough, and still be able to give us that gap. But if we are only relying on that low interest rate and not bringing a good business model to it, we will fail. The only thing that I emphasize as we dig in truly on the fundamental, you know, our conservatorship, our claims and counseling, our veterans' homes, those ones are working better, in my opinion, than our home loan program. And really digging in on the fundamentals, identifying from the first phone call in and even before that, the outreach to the veterans on this program. It's not solely within our home loans team to work on this. It's going to be truly seeing what are we going to hold ourselves accountable to and measure so that our communications team, the IT infrastructure that we need, the financial folks on board, that we really bring in all hands on deck from ODVA to truly try to grow this program. That was the original reason why the department stood up.
Let me follow up on that, Mr. Director. Council, we probably spent half of our chair's meeting with the presiding officer discussing the home loan program, its history, and the need to make institutional improvements in it, in which I think everybody in the room expressed the utmost confidence in your ability to get that done. But the reason I raise that issue is that generally, and Madam Vice Chair has been in these sorts of meetings, you know, generally they kind of go along, and once again this is a case of multiple members, senior members of the legislature that were in that meeting, raised the issue going, as you know, back to the 1980s to make sure that we get this program, that it becomes re-becomes a stellar program, but we make sure that it is sustainable, and the discussions that happened during the regular session in terms of some of the, we've been robbing to pay Peter to pay Paul here and make things happen, but that needs to be an emphasis, because the presiding officer did remind me of that, as did several ranking members during that meeting. And of course, they have an institutional memory. I was born when this did happen, okay? But they were in the legislature, you know, some 30 years ago when the first problem. And you're fully aware of all these things, and I'm only reemphasizing it because you have some ranking members and some majority members who raised that issue in the last couple of weeks. It's not about any specific issue. It's the deal that we had this problem, as you know, back in the 80s, and we want to make sure that we don't, especially in these austere fiscal times, in the future, that we stay on top of that issue.
Chair Boquist, you're right. Back to the 80s, we had 90% of the indebtedness of the state of Oregon with ODVA's home loan program. Clearly, we weren't funding as much off of bonds across the rest of state government at that time, but that was the full faith and credit of the state of Oregon hinging off of that program. Much different challenges today. That credit, the state of Oregon's credit is not at risk with this program. We've got great projections that we can pay off the bonds, but we've been heavily reliant on the Veterans Home Loan Program, not just to be a benefit of and to itself for our veterans, but it has funded much of our veteran services and other wraparound services. The legislature gave a great fund shift to make sure that veteran services is carved out to general fund now, but still, when we look at our human resources, director's office, our IT, our financial, much of our back-end support services are still funded off of the home loan program. So irregardless, you know, we're only serving 2,000 veterans right now and their families through this program, but it funds a core part of our agency. So our commitment is there to drive that, and it's always going to be a challenge, referencing back to the challenges in the 1980s, but very different challenges that we're digging on today. Within Veteran Services, we were happy to host General and Secretary Shinseki from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs at the end of August, and there is just a tremendous amount of change going on at the federal VA in terms of electronic claims and trying to reduce the backlog, and the state of Oregon and our county partners have a key role in that, and we're moving electronic as well in our claims processing. We finally got the last county on board with our Vetrospect, which are our cloud-based claims management system, that then when teamed with different outreach efforts like the extra $1 million that were appropriated out of the last session for veterans extended outreach, both to our youngest veterans as well as to Vietnam veterans who have never filed for benefits. Teaming that up with our cloud-based system is going to be a powerful tool to try to reduce that backlog and the delays that our veterans find in their claims and benefit system. Beyond that, we're also partnering with DMV and DHS to simply be able to find our veterans, knowing that those are sometimes key access points and large databases within state government. Make sure that we're asking through those processes when they sign up for DMV or they sign up for a program through DHS, that they have the opportunity to volunteer their information to come over to ODVA so we can reach out to them as well and get them linked to their benefits.
Mr. Director, at the DMV, is there a box on the form that you can check that says you're a veteran?
So right, Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, I got to get my programs correct because we're doing some donations through their registration page as well. Right now, the only information that we can't get from DMV that they collect would be their email address, and I believe the email address was the most important one for us. So what they've agreed to do is put a little icon on their site that links it over to ODVA's online registration form.
When they fill out their DMV form, is there a box on there that says they are a veteran?
I'd have to double check on the on the actual registration page. I'd have to double check.
Okay, because otherwise, how would you know?
So they've been asking, and okay. I assume it is part of now on their online form registration.
Okay, thank you.
So as good as ODVA is in our programs, we know that it's still going to be the larger partnerships that drive this work. That's partnerships across state agencies up to the federal behemoth, $150 billion budget that the federal VA will be advocating for, out to our tribes, to our counties. But it truly is that public-private partnership model that we're trying to crack. The Guard has stood up joining community forces, and I think for the long term, knowing that these issues are going to be 20, 30, 40 years that we're dealing with them, really looking at trying to reinvigorate that public-private partnership in a way that under-promises and over-delivers. It's very easy to set up 15 subcommittees on healthcare, education, employment, housing, all the different issues that veterans and their families care about, but it can quickly overwhelm the system in terms of how we staff that and how we budget for that. But we know that public-private partnership is going to be where the sweet spot is for ODVA to help coordinate. On broader outreach, we talked a little bit about the database and the DHS and DMV systems, truly bringing a 21st century communication strategy that crosses using gov delivery in terms of email subscriptions, a news blog, partnerships with county veteran service officers to build local websites, partnering with 211 at the state level on a similar effort, focused social media marketing that's not just for our younger veterans, but some of our largest users on Facebook are the Vietnam era folks. And we've been able, you know, in a benefit magazine, 40 pages featuring all of the federal and state and local benefits for our veterans. We've been able to measure our outreach at an impressive 62,000 veterans per month. And as we continue to partner across all the diverse sectors and agencies, that is only going to continue to grow. Are there any questions on the overarching strategy before I dig in specifically on some of our suicide efforts?
Questions, Senator?
Great.
Madam Vice Chair, please proceed.
So out of last session, Senate Bill 762 directed the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs to create a veteran suicide prevention and outreach program and a corresponding fund. I'm pleased to give you an update on that implementation efforts. September is Suicide Prevention Month across the nation for all of our citizens, including our military and veterans families. And I think this is one of the most complex issues that not just this department, but that society and the state of Oregon and our nation face. And it really speaks, it will be that partnership model, knowing that it is not one agency that is going to be able to address this. The different funding sources identified in Senate Bill 762 were any fund source, general fund or other funds appropriated by the legislature, a charitable checkoff option from the Department of Revenue on the state tax returns, and then also an option for when individuals are registering their vehicle with DMV for them to be able to link over and give a donation into the suicide prevention, the Veteran Suicide Prevention Fund. And this is, so we've got great data from public health. You know, I think it's 26% of all suicides in Oregon are veterans and military families. We're only about 10% of the population at large, so we're clearly overrepresented in our suicides. And when you dig through that report, so much data, but it still boggles the mind in terms of no one cause, no one answer, but knowing that mental health treatment works, upfront prevention works. And so we took this to heart this summer, knowing that it's not just going to be ODVA working on this effort, with a grant from SAMHSA, the federal version of our addictions and mental health, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. With a grant, we were able to host a workshop at the end of July that didn't just pull in the military veterans experts from our veteran service orgs, the Guard, the military family operations, but also our nonprofits, our addictions and mental health, public health, the federal VA, our county partners, hosted that workshop at the end of July. And really, you know, there was any number of issues we could work on, but where the center of gravity from that group really wanted to dig in on was on suicide prevention and beginning to drive those numbers down. The vision that we came up with overarching was service members, veterans, and their families thrive in Oregon. More specifically, the goal was to promote wellness and prevent suicide in service members, veterans, and their families. Out of that workshop, we just recently took a team of about 11 or 12 of us back to Baltimore to a state policy academy hosted again and funded by SAMHSA, to really learn what are the best practices that are going on around the nation at the federal level and also with our fellow states. So we went back to Baltimore, D.C. area with our team, and where we really landed on for where we need to work on is on the data side, knowing just what are the challenges that we face on suicide and what are the evidence-based programs that can help us begin to drive those numbers down. What ongoing structure, knowing that this is a partnership effort, how do we keep this effort going and how does it link in more closely to the joining community forces model on an ongoing and sustainable basis? And then really using a coordinated public information campaign, not just from ODVA and our diverse ways that we get information out, but really leveraging all of our partners, both in the nonprofits, on the crisis lines, the faith-based community, and the broader community. And there's a lot...
And I don't know, my intuitive sense is that after talking with some veterans, but I'm not sure that they're very representative of those that have committed suicide because we haven't, it's hard to do that. But my intuitive sense says that in the military training, you train, and killing is a very, that's a part of what you do when you go in the military. And it seems to me that some personalities or veterans killing someone and all of the torture and death that they see, I think, and I don't have evidence, I think this affects some personalities. And I don't know if the military has psychological screenings before they're even deployed. It'd be nice to know the propensity of There could be certain veterans that would psychologically be overwhelmed or will affect them. I don't know if that's part of the reason why so many commit, but I know some of the experiences that they have had with just the several readings that we've had. I can't help but feel that there are some men and women who are much more susceptible to being psychologically just devastated by what war is all about. And I know police force, they have psychological training. I don't know what it is, but, you know, there are just certain men that can go into the police force, or that's part of the criteria. And I was just wondering, the military just seems to take anybody and everybody and doesn't care, you know, they don't. Well, anyway, do you sort of get my drift on this?
So, Chair Boquist, Senator Montes Anderson, I think there is often of our veteran suicide, probably 95% of them are males that don't naturally want to reach out for help always. I think it's less about the segment of our population that's in the military as much as the complexity of the experiences that they have both in war and in just simply the challenges of serving their country and bouncing from sometimes base to base. But there's not necessarily a culture of always reaching out for help. Even when you sprain your ankle in training, you take the Motrin, but you're still going to be training. So really bringing out this issue and talking about it, not just throughout the leadership ranks within the military, but across our veterans community, I feel like that's one of the most viable ways to have an honest conversation about this and say there are mental health challenges that are not just our military and veterans, but our citizens face. Using the lens of veterans in military, people can put themselves in their shoes and say, I can understand why, given the impact of war, that there may be mental health issues. In a way, sometimes they can't relate to our everyday citizens on mental health issues. And trying to use that lens to generate a positive conversation as we do this public information campaign can only help.
Chair Wilkins. Director, do you have any statistics indicating whether the suicides are more prevalent in active duty that have seen combat action as compared to those that have just, say, for example, been stationed in Germany or Korea or wherever where there is no action? Is there any numbers to correlate that?
So, Senator Boquist, Chair Boquist, Senator Olson, there's not great data in terms of by era. There's not great data in terms of did they experience combat or not. But anecdotally, it isn't always combat. So it's hard to hinge solely on that as the one reason. Where we do have good data is more on that gender in terms of, well, we do get a little bit of the era given the spikes by age. So you can see in the public health report that I can get to your offices, we've got 2012's data, and it's going to be that spike in the 18 to 24-year-old market or demographic, and then our older veterans as well. So kind of the beginning and the tail end of our population are those spikes. But again, not great data in terms of were they actually in combat or not. One thing that came out of our summit back with SAMHSA are the tremendous resources. When you have a $150 billion budget and 20,000 mental health workers just working for the federal VA system, a lot of resources that we can tap into where we can put our local spin on it without having to recreate the wheel at the local level. And I think the larger conversation beyond that data, beyond what structures we have these conversations, and beyond the larger public information campaign, we know that only about a third of our veterans tie into actual VA healthcare systems. That's everything from the C-Box, the clinics out in Bend in rural Oregon, to the full medical centers in Portland and Roseburg. some of our work will be getting our outreach and our claims and counseling, trying to drive more folks to their benefits in that VA healthcare system. But with the tremendous changes across coordinated care organizations and with healthcare transformation coming, there's going to be a lot of new models, new payments, new incentives that we need to make sure that we better link our VA system with our coordinated care organizations. It's been a challenge given how much change is coming at us so quickly on the healthcare front, but we know through the Medicaid side and through the Medicare side and the coordinated care organizations, there's going to be more upfront prevention, more screenings that are going to be digging in on mental health and making sure we have a seamless referral system from our coordinated care organizations where appropriate to the federal VA healthcare system, so that we can continue to rely on those federal dollars and begin to spread those resources, thin resources on healthcare across all of our citizens. But happy to take any questions.
I have three, Mr. Director. Two aren't yours, but you're going to get to punt anyway. And one is yours, so I'll start with yours. I think you and I exchanged some emails with Senator Johnson and Vice Chair Melissa Anderson. The three of us were, you know, beating our heads against the wall even to the waning days of the regular session to get, you know, suicide prevention funding dollars because of shortfalls in the federal system. And could you just bring us up to date? You've updated Senator Johnson and I emailed that on to Senator Monis Anderson, but for the public record, where are we on the suicide prevention lines, the mechanics of it, so on and so forth, if you would, please. And before you start, I think for the record, I think you clearly know we gave it to your department because of specific reasons.
So Chair Boquist, members of the committee, one tool in our toolbox on suicide is going to be that frontline crisis prevention system. Obviously still much work to go in terms of further developing crisis teams that then go out and reach out to these folks. We have that in the metro area, and continue to build both our mental health resources within the Veterans Administration system and our coordinated care organizations. But it's been fascinating as we've pulled together the diverse partners, even just on that small crisis line piece, still so many different people in the mix across ODVA was grateful to get the $350,000 appropriation out of this last session for a crisis line. The Guard's been contracting with federal resources for a line for the National Guard. The Addictions and Mental Health folks within the Oregon Health Authority have a $750,000 State of Oregon crisis line. They also have about a $470,000 contract on just alcohol and drug referral resources. And then we still have county line, mental health lines in every county being staffed. And the one number that we truly hinge off of in terms of veteran service orgs, in terms of ODVA, is still the federal VA suicide crisis line that's staffed 24 hours a day and also has the ability for text and chat online. Digging in on that system, it's very clear to me that it feels like we're not having an honest conversation about duplication of resources, and that we need to say, what is Oregon's approach overall across all of our agencies on crisis lines? And I think those conversations are beginning to happen out of this suicide prevention effort conversation. But it's been a process that has slowed up what was meant to be a very quick RFP process. So I believe we're probably going to launch with that RFP shortly, if not this week, to do a specific $350,000 appropriation on a crisis line specifically for military and veterans families. Currently, we talked about that federal VA number. Lines for Life here in Oregon is that overflow currently for that federal VA line. They're also the main contractor for Oregon Health Authority and Addictions and Mental Health lines. We will have an open process and an open bidding process, but I think going forward we need to have more coordination on specifically this crisis lines. I feel like tend to lend themselves to centralization and coordination, so that we can then further so that we know clearly this is the line. If you are in crisis, whatever your crisis, whether it's military, veterans, citizens, tribal, women, youth, that we are be able to truly market one line effectively for the state of Oregon.
Go ahead, Madam Chair, or Madam Vice Chair, I'll let you go first before I open fire.
History shows that veterans do call Lines for Life. and they actually train veterans to deal with those calls. And I don't know why some military or veterans would prefer to call Lines for Life rather than the military, but when we start fragmenting the issue, I think that is in absolute conflict. I hear what you're saying, that you just want to have control over it and just have all those veterans call, but that's not to the military line, but that's not how the system is. And I would hope, I mean, if you want to have your own line, which I am not opposed to at all, that you don't just say no, nothing to this one, who's actually doing a horrendous amount of good work for our veterans too. So that's my.
The Chair Boquist, Senator Miles Anderson, I think we're speaking the same. I think it does need to be one coordinated line that has expertise embedded within it on military veterans, but it's not ODVA's expertise to run that line. We're not well served if we spread those resources out across multi-organizations. But we need to have a process owner for that, and I think it's going to be through addictions and mental health, their kind of core expertise, linking to public health, linking to ODVA, and building out what is that honest budget request for the state of Oregon to support one line going forward. There are some dynamics within the military culture, specifically, where folks don't want to be flagged for their command. So there is a natural tendency sometimes to, DOD refers folks to that VA line. The Lines for Life line has been successful on that front, given that it's anonymous, given that it's separate from that command mentality. That plays a huge role as just the cultural training awareness of those call takers if they're not veterans themselves. But centralizing those resources and making sure it's more coordinated is the only way that we're going to be able to actually, with what I described, you could refer them to five different places, and if we have five different folks all in charge of crisis lines, it's going to be a nightmare to make sure we're actually achieving outcomes.
And I'll follow that on, Mr. Greger, because I think, at least on the Senate side, which it is the Senate side that argued and got the funds put into the budget that passed, I guess let me back up just a little bit here so I can try and give some wiggle room here for new leadership, both in yourself and the military department. Wars are won by leadership. 3 years, 8 months, World War II, 27 countries, two major Axis powers defeated. We've now been at war a whole lot longer than 3 years and 8 months. Suicide prevention in the military ranks is a leadership function, period, end of subject. Buck stops here. I mean, civilians that aren't used to the military always say, well, I talked to this bureaucrat, or I talked to this chief, or I talked to that chief. BS. I mean, you're a former Marine officer. It's the commander that's in charge. It is a leadership function. Bringing that down to the state, I mean, the legislature has not been overly happy on at least several of the suicide line, suicide prevention approaches that has been taken, which is why the money wasn't put in the military department's budget. Okay? Having said that, there's a new leadership team, and they are just on the ground for 30 days. And they are, getting up to speed, taking action, and making changes and improvements in a system that, there are a few places that have fallen through the cracks. And so in the military department, in the Air Guard, and the Army Guard, you got a new adjutant general, you have new assistant adjutant generals then coming on board on the air side, so on and so forth. And so, there's change afoot, and there's leadership in place. My point is this. It's as the legislature put up funding because there was a failure at the federal level and a failure of implementation of how the funds that they did receive should have been implemented. And as you point out, there's at least five different lines out there. Two or three of the lines are pretty good. One stands out above the others, and two of them aren't worth calling. You might as well take your quarter, plug it in a tree as a ranger, and phone home to ET because it's just useless. But as at this point, it's not just the Guard. And one of the reasons it's over in your department is we're not just talking about the Guard. We have Army Reserve, active Army that are getting out that are veterans and part of the 70% that don't have federal funds, followed up by Air Force, airmen that are coming off of active duty, Air Force Reserve, Marine Corps Reserve, so on and so forth.
And, you know, while we all would like to say it's a federal function, the fact of the matter is the feds, in many cases, are abandoning Oregon for whatever reason. Budget shortfalls, sequestration, doesn't really matter. But you are absolutely right. There are economies of scale that we need to address in terms of, you know, getting the right group of people doing all of it together. But as you well know, you've been there. I mean, the military guy doesn't talk well to the shrink from, you know, DHS. Okay? It just doesn't happen. They're not on the same wavelength. And so it doesn't do much good for them to talk to those sort of people. So you're going to have to kind of, I guess, thread the needle in that. And I'm not looking for an answer. I'm just telling you. If there's disagreement from the other committee members, I know Senator Johnson, and we've had this long discussion with the appropriators. It took us beating our heads against the wall to get our colleagues across the aisle in the far chamber to even agree to the number that we put up. It's not the number we wanted, but that's the direction we're going. Madam Vice Chair, you want to add anything? So with that, I do have two other things that I want to bring to your attention, and they're not yours, but as you said, the Secretary was here. I think with the CCOs and the transition of healthcare, I mean, TRICARE, TRICARE West, how that is implemented and plugged into the CCOs is becoming problematic. I'm seeing an increase in those complaints. If you want a real earful, my wife is in the building during the 3 days of legislative session, and she'll give you an earful about TRICARE because she's a retired military officer. And, I mean, since we have PERS, I mean, getting TRICARE to do anything after PERS does it, you know, is bloody well impossible. And then it's, you know, I had another complaint that came in on TRICARE. Of course, when you actually apply for Social Security, you lose your military TRICARE retirement benefits, and you plug into the Social Security side, which, you know, of course, most veterans don't know that. So when veterans get to that Social Security age, they suddenly are calling our offices saying, hey, I had... TRICARE or healthcare or veterans benefits, and now that I signed up for Social Security or I'm a Social Security agent to fill out the forms, I lost those benefits. And we have not successfully, I think, in the last three sessions, you know, TRICARE comes and makes it, well, one session they refuse to come, but then another session they come and they're just the contractor and do the dog paddle propaganda dance. But there are problems with TRICARE. And so even in mental health areas, and we've all known getting access to people who will take TRICARE. But TRICARE, you know, continues to be problematic, which is not your problem. But I know you and your colleagues around the state, the directors get together, and the group of you have some weight with the Secretary and the federal government to push on that. Because anything, we are a whole lot better than we used to be. We have 70% of veterans not getting benefits. But mm-hmm. I can tell you when we started this, we were around, you know, 90% of veterans didn't get benefits. So the veteran service officers have been doing a remarkable job. The backlog of claims, as you point to that. But, you know, the more we can try and get the federal government to shoulder its responsibility, the better it would be. Madam Vice Chair?
You said it well.
Senator Olson? Closing comments, Mr. Director?
Chair Boquist, members of the committee, I'm just excited by the work that's still to come. We've got a great team in place. We're moving in the right direction. Are we where we need to be for our veterans and military families today? No. But I truly believe we are on a good course where we're going to be able to not just tap into the goodwill going forward on budgets, but truly showing the governor and the legislature and our citizens that we are achieving outcomes for our veterans and their families that will also spread that benefits across our system. So I just appreciate having you here today, and look forward to engaging with your colleagues this week.
And we appreciate your hard work. Madam Vice Chair.
I want to thank Mr. Smith for coming to Troutdale. We have Rip Caswell, who is a bronze sculptor, and he made a sculpture of Admiral Nimitz, who oversaw all of the during World War II, but my dad was in the Navy, and so he was also under him. Well, this sculpture is turning into a national monument, and it was sent over to Pearl Harbor and is in front of the USS
Missouri.
Missouri, right. And they just dedicated that, I think, last week. But the point I want to make here is Cameron Smith is a relative of Admiral Nimitz, and no one knows that. So can you tell them it's on your mother's side, correct?
Chair Boquist, Senator Monis Anderson, with a last name like Smith, I've been able to fly below the radar. But with the Fleet Admiral as my great-grandfather on my mother's side, knew his son, who was also a rear admiral in the Navy. Clearly, I had to chart my own course in the Marine Corps because I was never going to be able to compete with that history on the Navy side. But something that influences my service in the Marines and also my continued dedication on the veterans front. But it was just a strange Oregon connection to have that Rip Caswell do that in Troutdale and ship that off to Hawaii and Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, we had a nice affair on a beautiful sunny day.
Well, Director Smith would be curious to know that I actually worked with Captain Lejeune, who is, what, the great-grandson or something?
I was going to say, I didn't realize you were that old.
That's right.
And he was much younger than you, I hate to say, but that was very recently at Gulfport. But, you know, and of course, in the Marine Corps, when you see the name Captain Lejeune, right, the first thing you do is you step back.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, who does this guy know, right?
But, you know, so there's some interesting relatives out there. And for the public's benefit, I'd point out that, you know, unfortunately, many committees in the legislature tend to deal on negativities and things like that, and we don't deal so much on the positives, but we do have a good military department, we do have a good veterans department, there's always room for improvements, and there's always a few hiccups there and there, and so I don't want the public that's sitting at home watching the TV screen thinking that, you know, we're all beating up, but unfortunately we're in the doomsday business on this committee by trade, and the legislature generally doesn't get a lot of people calling you up and saying, oh, you're doing a great job. It's they're calling up because there's a problem with something like that, and those are conveyed. Again, Director Smith, we appreciate you coming forward, and we look forward to working with you in the interim.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Colleagues, next month we have the military department that is up, and for those members of the public that have issues that the Veterans Committee maybe to address, we are on the webpage in the Oregon Legislature. You can contact counsel, and we'd be happy to put you on the agenda or try and see if we can help you out. A lot of times, many of the veterans functions that come forward, the various constituents or the various members send it from constituents, various members send it out to the various agencies, and about 50-60% of the time there's a positive result, and about 100% of the time or 90% you get an answer to why something works or doesn't work. So we'd encourage you to, you know, be part of the legislative process. And with that, the record should reflect that President Courtney is excused today on business to the Senate. Madam Vice Chair, anything?
Yeah.
Senator Olson?
Yeah.
If not, colleagues, we are done for the month.
Thank you. Thank you.
If not, colleagues, we are done for the month.